When the Human Rights Act was enacted, it could properly be said that it wasn't so very radical, given the constitutional developments and potential and role of the principle of legality at common law. So the message was, gear up, but take it in your stride. There was a voice. The voice interrupted the in-flight entertainment. It was Lord Hoffman. The case was Sims, and it was 1999. He said, the Human Rights Act is unlikely to involve radical change to notions of fundamental human rights. The common law will now be supplemented by a specific text. The principle of legality will be expressly enacted in Section 3, and there'll be a new statutory remedy of a declaration of incompatibility in unusual cases. We've had 15 years of the flight since. The domestic protection of human rights using the supplementary text, and the courts making choices. The art of the possible under Section 3. The approach to Strasbourg authorities in circumstances, and you might want to remember this phrase if you're reading a document called Protecting Human Rights in the United Kingdom, the Conservatives' Proposals for Changing Britain's Human Rights Laws. Under the Human Rights Act, there is no formal requirement to treat Strasbourg authority as binding. And they made choices about the discretion in relation to the statutory remedy of declarations of incompatibility. And they had a very handy judicial reflex as they piloted the flight during those last 15 years. Because if there's any criticism, they are able to say, well, we're just doing what Parliament told us we had to do. Because the Human Rights Act contains duties and we are complying with them. That was particularly handy because they were able to say, well, this is old school constitutionality. The supremacy of Parliament is key. It's the cornerstone. As Lord Steyne said in 2002, the supremacy of Parliament is the paramount principle of our constitution. So if we sit when we're the Privy Council and we're doing human rights cases that come from other countries, then it's constitutional supremacy. But old school, if we're looking at human rights and we're sitting as an English court, then it's parliamentary supremacy. Well, today, with this document in the seat pocket, there's another voice on the flight. And the voice says this: in the event of turbulence, and if the cabin lights temporarily dip, and the repeal light is lit, please return to your seats and fasten your seat belts. But don't worry, because the emergency floor lighting will point the way. If we were in a fairy tale, I would talk about crumbs dropped in the forest by judges who possibly knew what might be coming. But because we're on a flight, I'll talk about the lights that you don't notice because they're in the floor until they are needed and suddenly they shine. Constitutional fundamentals and old school? I don't think so. The rule of law, so that's monopoly of control, reason and freedom, no Latin. The rule of law, enforced by the courts, is the ultimate controlling factor on which our constitution is based. Lord Hope in Jackson, waiting on the floor to light up. You go back to Lord Bridge in 1991, in a case called X Limited and Morgan Grampian. He said it's not parliamentary supremacy, it's a dual sovereignty. The maintenance of the rule of law is every bit as important as the democratic franchise. The rule of law rests on twin foundations. One of them is parliamentary sovereignty, and the other is the sovereignty of the Queen's courts. Next crumb or light. constitutional rights. Now he's gone, I can quote him. Lord Justice Laws, 2002. 2002, in the Metric Martyrs, Thoburn. In the present state of its maturity, the common law has come to recognise that there exist what should properly be classified as constitutional rights. Constitutional rights. In 2000, in a case called Lightfoot, same judge, no Latin. Constitutional rights, that special class of rights which, in truth, everyone living in a democracy under the rule of law ought to enjoy. The potential of those lights in the floor beginning to shine. So when the Hunting Act is challenged, you look in the law reports of Jackson and you find this. The case raises an issue which is justiciable. This is a challenge to primary legislation. It's a justiciable issue. It's the function of the court to examine the validity of purported legislation where it raises a question of law. And I am not reading from any judgment. That is in the submissions of the Attorney General who was defending the Hunting Act in that case. Lord Bingham said it's a bit weird. He said he had a sense of strangeness, but he said there's no breach of constitutional propriety for the court to decide a question of law. Lord Steyne and Lord Hope both said in that case, the supremacy of Parliament is a construct of the common law. It is a general principle, but we do not have an uncontrolled constitution, and it is not unthinkable for the courts to step in if there was oppressive primary legislation or the curtailment of judicial review. We've already seen, they said, step by step, that parliamentary supremacy is not absolute. It is gradually but surely being qualified. And you can go right back to 1841 and find the Chief Justice, Lord Chief Justice, in the Cheltenham Commissioners when there was an ouster of judicial review saying, quote, the statute cannot affect our right and duty to see justice executed. Lord Justice Laws, again, in Cart, at the level of the High Court, held that the rule of law required that if you'd got statutes, you had to have courts, and courts had to give authoritative judicial resolution of questions arising under statutory law, and Parliament could not dispense with judicial review. That was expressly affirmed by Lady Howe when Cart got all the way to the top. Next crumb, the common law prism for looking at fundamental rights. Brilliant Court of Appeal case, you'll probably know it, called Guardian News in 2012. The newspaper, The Guardian, were looking for disclosure of materials that hadn't been read out in open court in extradition proceedings. They came along with their lawyers and they argued on the basis of the ECHR Article 10. It was all a bit dodgy. It didn't sound as if it was really going to work. Somebody intervened, probably you, and said, well, here's some comparative law from some other countries in the world. And don't we have a principle called open justice at common law? And the Court of Appeal said, thank God for that. This isn't required by Article 10 of the ECHR, but it is required by the common law principle of open justice, articulated in human rights case law from elsewhere in the world. And Lord Justice Toulson, as he was, said it, and we all wrote it down. The development of the common law did not come to an end on the passing of the Human Rights Act. It is in vigorous and flourishing health, and it can illuminate the way. FAM, that you've heard about, Joanna talked about, the deprivation of citizenship case. Supreme Court pretty clear, because citizenship is such an important status, you deprive someone of that important status, there will be proportionality review. We don't really need the ECHR or EU law for that, thank you very much. That's just common law. The common law scrutinises, it looks at weight, it looks at balance, it can contextualise the intensity of review where important rights are at stake. And Lord Kerr, bless him, in the in Ian Steele's housing benefit cap case, SG, he's got there. And he's right. He said he couldn't understand. It is not easy, typical understated way, not easy to find the justification for refusing to recognise rights which are enshrined in an international human rights convention to which the United Kingdom has subscribed. Not easy to find that justification. And that's why he was prepared to invoke the Convention on the Rights of the Child in domestic law directly. And it's right, because those Sims line of cases, those principle of legality cases that preceded the Human Rights Act, so the October 2000 didn't necessarily have any magic, were all about recognising that the common law marched step in step with the ECHR. Why was that? Because the ECHR has rights which are enshrined and which are not going to be renounced, if you look in your seat pocket and read that document, in an international human rights convention to which the United Kingdom has subscribed. So that one's waiting to be lit up. And let me just go back to 2006 in the Privy Council. This is a case called Khoirati, K-H-O-Y-R-A-T-T-Y, Khoirati, a case from Mauritius. I think this could become very important. The idea of democracy involves these concepts. Number one, the people must decide who should govern them. Number two, write this one down. Fundamental rights must be protected by an impartial and independent judiciary. And number three, to reconcile the first two, the separation of powers operates to ensure that the legislature has its proper place, and so does the executive, but so does the judiciary. And if that's right, it doesn't matter whether it's Mauritius or whether it's the United Kingdom, if that is the principled approach to constitutionality. So when we go back to that line of Sims authorities on the principle of legality, you start with cases like JCWI in 1996. This was regulations by the Secretary of State mandating the destitution of asylum seekers. Sounds familiar? We had that for years. But it started with secondary legislation, and the Court of Appeal said it was unlawful, it was ultra vires, because it was contrary to the principle of legality, because the principle of legality recognises fundamental rights, and they can't be abrogated, except possibly by clear and express words of primary legislation. But the reasoning in that case in the Court of Appeal nearly 20 years ago was that here was a measure so uncompromisingly draconian, creating a life so destitute that no civilised nation could tolerate it. The human rights at issue in the case, and he says in terms, it's not necessary to look at the European Convention on Human Rights. The human rights at issue are so basic that resort to an international convention is not necessary. And he applies a case from 1803 called the Eastbourne Inhabitants. The law of humanity, anterior to all laws, obliges us to afford relief. Then, of course, we go through the prism of the ECHR and Limbuela, and we've got primary legislation, we've got the Human Rights Act, so then they can decide is destitution compatible with Article 3? No, of course it isn't. And there's your solution, applying the supplementary text. But if it is right that there is a law of humanity anterior to all laws, human rights so basic it cannot be necessary to resort to an international convention, don't tell me that the principle of legality cannot protect fundamental rights today and tomorrow, whatever happens to the Human Rights Act. Daly was a case where Lord Bingham said, well, this would be this exclusion of an inmate while the cell is being searched and legal professional privileged communications are being looked at, not read, looked at, is incompatible with Article 8, but I don't need Article 8. It violates the common law. It's unlawful under the principle of legality. And the same judge, Lord Bingham, when he threw out the idea that you could rely on torture evidence in any court in this country, says, well, the torture convention in Article 15 wouldn't allow it. I don't think Article 6 of the ECHR would allow it. But none of that really matters, because the common law won't allow it. The common law protections against torture prevent that. And that's the route that he chooses. And one wonders whether the judges could see a bigger picture in which the reflex of we are doing what Parliament has said was fine while we were in an age that Parliament had enacted legislation of that kind. But there is something bigger and something stronger and something that waits just in case the lights dip and the turbulence is encountered. Third voice. The rebalancing switch was located as a result of the emergency lighting in the floor. I'm able to reassure you all that the flight path has been restored. In fact, the pilots informed me that we may now be able to fly at even higher altitude, possibly stronger, faster, and further. They had a map that they'd been given. It's been taken away. They've been given a different one now. And there's a voice being coming across the radio to them, actually a little bit of an argument going on. Somebody seemed to think they were air traffic control, telling the pilots where the plane needed to go. But that's all been resolved now. And the pilots are able to reassure me that we can go wherever there is inhumanity and suffering, dropping the judicial aid packages that will restore the position. You say to the air steward who comes around, that was all a bit undramatic. The turbulence wasn't really very bad, it was all quite smooth. Didn't hear much shouting. I can't see any blood on the walls. Wasn't this parliamentary vandalism, tearing something down, only to find that something else is dramatically rebuilt that's even taller, or pruning back something that's growing to try and kill it, only to find that it fights back and it can grow even better than before? Well, says the steward, in a way it was, but that's not really the way they operate, these pilots. They're a bit more softly spoken than that. It's all a bit quiet, the still, small voice of calm. Because you know what? They're quite clever. They are quite clever. Thinking about it, I remember when Lord Justice Sedley was told that he was a heretic because you couldn't have a substantive legitimate expectation that had anything other than a rationality test. It's a case called Hargreaves. It was about prisoners. Coughlin came along, and it was one in the listing, because Coughlin was listed in front of Sedley and Lord Wolfe, sitting in the Court of Appeal. But they didn't huff and puff and say Hargreaves was wrong. They just quietly said it was distinguishable. Hargreaves has never been followed, so far as I'm aware, ever since that day. It became extinct, but in a very understated and undramatic way. But probably the best example of the genius, Chester, 2013, Supreme Court. This is the big one. Prisoners voting. Gone back again. The politicians are watching. There's going to be an outcry. Strasbourg has spoken, it's pretty clear. So clever were the Supreme Court that they managed to get David Cameron to say publicly the next day that their decision was, quote, a great victory for common sense. And they achieved this by dismissing the appeals. So the prisoners' appeals were dismissed. What they actually said was that the ban was plainly incompatible with the ECHR. There was no point for having any further dialogue with Strasbourg because it was crystal clear. But since they had already granted a declaration of incompatibility, there was no point in granting another declaration of incompatibility, so the appeal is dismissed. They know what they're doing, and they know why those lights were planted in the floor for when they were needed. And if the British Bill of Rights and Responsibilities now tells the courts that they shouldn't allow trivial claims, that there is no formal requirement to treat the Strasbourg court's decisions as binding, but the ECHR has not been renounced, indeed the text is going to be in the Act, what is wanted is a credible and just application of human rights where the court's role, the domestic court's role, is not undermined, where the protection of human rights is a hallmark of democratic society. Well, there's the piece of paper that we're now being given from Parliament as judges. Of course, we're very interested in that. We've read that. We've understood it. We will now hear submissions on it. And we will read relevant authorities, even if they're comparative authorities, and possibly even the occasional Strasbourg authority, and we will then decide how the rights contained in this new bill are properly to be applied. At the edges, though, where it is said that now something is unavailable because these new statutory rights, as they have been reformulated, they yield to clear and express language in primary legislation. Oh, and by the way, you can't invoke human rights overseas. So if there's anything a British public authority does abroad, like, for example, torturing somebody in detention, you won't find the answer in this document because it only applies to the territory of the United Kingdom. Well, that's very interesting. We're very interested in that and what Parliament has said about that and whether that set of rights should apply and give us the answer in this case. We'll need a bit of help to understand when primary legislation is clear, Mr. Eadie, so that it overrides fundamental rights under this document that is supposed to give rise to the just application of human rights, given their importance in a democratic society. So we might need a little bit of help about that, and we might have some choices to make about that. But we would also like some help with this, please. What's happened alongside these statutory rights to the constitutional rights that had been recognised many years ago, 20 years ago? What's happened to the constitutional principle of legality, which insisted that power could not be exercised in a way that abrogated fundamental rights? What's happened to the principle that recognised that international human rights instruments, there's still one called the European Convention on Human Rights, should inform the common law in identifying the incidence and shape of rights to be enforced in a domestic court? And perhaps you could help us with this, Mr. Eadie. Suppose somewhere near the sea, in a foreign country, where people wearing orange are put inside a cage. This new document doesn't appear to give them any rights, because they're not in the jurisdiction of the United Kingdom. But you're not saying, are you, that the constitutional rights that are applicable under the rule of law have ceased to be applicable because this new legislation has been enacted? Schedule 1 of the Human Rights Act was only a supplementary text. Any new statute will be a supplementary text. The principle of legality, enacted as it was for 15 years, and we'll see how much longer, as a statutory rule, was and remains a constitutional principle of English common law. In the case of a conflict between a statute and a fundamental right, well, there'll no longer be the statutory remedy of a declaration of incompatibility. All right, we cannot any longer give the statutory remedy of a declaration of incompatibility, but that raises a question. It doesn't give an answer. And those three features are the same features that Lord Hoffman, when his voice came over the tannoy interrupting the in-flight entertainment, told us about on the birth of the Human Rights Act. Which leaves us here. If the Human Rights Act is repealed, it can properly be said, in an understated whisper, that it won't be so very radical, given the continuing constitutional developments and the role of the principle of legality or principle of constitutionality at common law. And so the message will be, gear up and take it in your stride.